17 Annual Wolf Report, and this is a briefing.
Good afternoon, Commission and Director, Deputy Store, Deputy Director Store. Thank you very much for having us this afternoon. It's always nice to be able to come in and present the update and the numbers that we have on wolves as they've recolonized the state. And so I'd like to take you through the beginning part of this presentation. It's going to be a little bit redundant just to kind of cover where we are on the wolf plan and some of the objectives. So we're just going to go over some of those basic objectives and then kind of the wolf recovery in Washington, its listing status, and kind of how we monitor the population, as well as look at where the population trends are right now. We're going to talk about some livestock wolf interactions and then our research updates and some of the outreach stuff that we're doing. And so our basic, our wolf plan has four main objectives. We're basically looking to restore self-sustaining wolf populations to Washington. We want to maintain healthy ungulate populations throughout the state as well. And we also certainly want to manage wolf and livestock conflicts and make sure wolves have a minimal impact on people as they recolonize the state and on their pets and livestock. And then it's also, we want to develop an understanding and promote coexistence, realize that wolves are just another critter on the landscape and they're just out there and people accept them as another species in Washington that we're lucky to have. So, you know, wolves are returning to Washington through a number of ways. We've had them coming in from British Columbia and Idaho and Oregon. That's how a lot of the original packs, they just dispersed into the state. Now that we're starting to get wolves established in Washington over the last 10 years, those packs themselves are actually assisting in the expansion and recolonization into the range in Washington. And so they're naturally recolonizing the state. We haven't moved any wolves around. They're coming in on their own. So wolves are still federally listed in the western two-thirds of the state. So there's a little line that runs down basically where Highway 97 is, right down that eastern third of the state there. There's no federal wolf recovery requirements in that area, and the status of Washington was not figured into the NRM, the Northern Rocky Mountain delisting. So the western part of the state still maintains federal listing status as endangered. They just recently proposed a rule in March 15th of 2019 to propose delisting the gray wolf federally. And so, but that said, they would still maintain the endangered species listing status statewide by Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so that would maintain, and it is currently statewide in Washington that is covered under that status. We have the state under the wolf conservation management plan, which was developed in 2011. There's three separate recovery areas that we're looking to show that wolves have expanded throughout the range in Washington. And we'd like to see, we'll cover this a little bit more in depth at the end of the presentation, where we are in recovery. We'd like to see a minimum of four successful breeding pairs in each of those recovery, areas to get to that delisting. The management in Washington is done in conjunction cooperation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, with tribal managers, co-managers, work with the Colville Confederated Tribes, as well as the Spokane tribes in northeastern Washington. And as wolves recolonize the rest of the state, we'll work with our other, co-manage with the other tribes as the recolonization occurs throughout the state. So I talked about successful breeding pairs and packs. Those are kind of our metrics of how we assess wolf recovery in the state. A pack is just two or more wolves traveling together within a defined territory. Successful breeding pairs is a male and female raising two pups or more until December 31st of that year. And so that's when we do our annual surveys, is right after December 31st each year. We start January 1, and we start counting each of those packs and finding out. It's the most stable time of year for those numbers. There's snow on the ground. The vegetation's off the trees. When we're doing aerial surveys, it's a good time for us to be able to census those populations where we can see them. We've got snow on the ground in much of the state and good tracking conditions, and so that allows us to get those counts then. When we're actually monitoring those populations, much of that starts through sighting reports from the public, and also on occasion if we get called on a depredation where livestock has been injured. But we've got tools online that you can report a wolf observation and have you can upload remote camera images or phone cell phone images of tracks and things like that. And that really helps us as wolves are recolonizing. They tend to use our roads and trail systems, and when people are out hiking and snowmobiling and hunting and doing things and recreating in our state, they can send in those reports if they happen to come across any wolf sign out there. Helps us find new packs. Once we do have some good sign of those animals, we'll follow up with remote camera surveys and tracking surveys in those areas. And then if it's during the summer, we'll actually do ground captures. We'll use traps to capture those wolves and put collars on. If we have a collar in the pack, we can actually use a helicopter and fly in and dart those animals and put a collar on another member of the pack. But in order to find them in the winter, it really helps to have a collar already, and we just supplement and add a second collar into that pack with aerial captures in the wintertime. And so this past year, we captured 9 wolves from 8 different packs. The population is very dynamic throughout the year. Wolves disperse out of the state. Wolves die. You know, a lot of things can happen. And so the number of animals we monitor changes pretty regularly, and the number of wolves on the landscape can change throughout the year as well. But we monitored 20 wolves over that time. From 15 different packs last year. At some time, we had at least 20 wolves collared throughout the state. We're currently monitoring 18. Actually, since I put these numbers together, one collar has stopped sending data, and another wolf was killed. And so we're actually monitoring 16 collars right now from 9 different packs. And so that number does change, and we're actually coming into a time where we can start trapping again and try and get a few more collars out. And so we'll be looking to do that.
How many collars you have in the blues right at the moment?
You know, there's one collar in the pack, the Butte Creek pack right now. That was in the Tushy pack, but she dispersed and moved down. And created the Butte Creek pack. She's got 2 individuals. So the Tushy pack, none of the other packs have collars right now down there.
Thank you.
But we'll be working on that this spring. So through that monitoring, we've ended up with 27 packs on the landscape. And this is a map of their distribution, where we found them. Some things to look at. So we had one pack that actually disbanded this past year. The Five Sisters pack was on the map last year. We searched on several different occasions, and we couldn't find any sign that they were out there any longer. But we did have a couple new packs, the Sherman, OPT, Nason, Diapsid Creek, and Nanum, that came back or that were new packs on the landscape. And so that's been really promising as we get in. Well, the biggest some of the biggest things is in the North Cascades. I guess I can't point on these, but the Diapsid Creek up in Skagit County is a new pack. It's the first pack in Western Washington. And so it's really exciting to see the North Cascades established a couple new packs, and the Nanum pack just east of the Tiana Way down in the southern part of that map is also a new pack this year. The other exciting thing with this pack is there's three successful breeding pairs in the North Cascades recovery area. Oh, great. Thank you. So the Tianaway pack, the Lookout pack, and Loop Loop pack are all three successful breeding pairs this year. And so when I talked earlier about the recovery objectives of four successful breeding pairs in each recovery area, we're just one successful breeding pair away from the recovery goal for that recovery region. We did a number of surveys in the South Cascades. We have seen some good remote camera images, of an individual wolf on occasion. We've had some really good images of tracks. I'm positive we've had individual wolves moving through the South Cascades, but we've not seen pack activity in the South Cascades yet. So we'll keep monitoring that for sure. And we've had a number of places in the North Cascades. We did do some surveys up by Stehekin, and we've been checking out some areas north of Leavenworth. We just have been doing some surveys northwest of Mount Rainier, where we've had good reports trying to follow up on those things. And so we're constantly looking for new packs and sign throughout the state. I brought this slide up last year. I just want to reiterate a little bit about the ecology of wolves. These animals are very territorial, so you see those polygons on the map where you've got the boundaries. But wolves tend to patrol those territories, and they're a family unit. And they, you've got the breeding pair, and then you've got their pups from 1 year and perhaps a pups from the second year that help raise the litter of the year. And so that cohesive family unit maintains that territory of about 300 to 350 square miles. So it's a pretty good size area. And you can see the movements. It's kind of like a wagon wheel. And during the springtime, they might have a pack or rendezvous site, and that'd be those clusters kind of in the center. And then they do the patrolling pattern out around the edges. And so it's important to note that, you know, when you're counting these numbers and you're looking at the consistent number of wolves on the landscape, that it's that family group in that particular area. And, to kind of follow that up a little bit further, this is a map of the last 4 years of where our packs have established. And when you look at the distribution of those packs in Northeast Washington, it's the same packs year after year. There's something we call site fidelity, where those packs stay in the same area. The Sherman pack, even though it wasn't on the map last year, this year again we have the Sherman pack right where it was, back in 2016. And so that kind of thing, I equate it to like a subdivision, or where you've got houses broken out and you have the white picket fence and a family living there, and their food source. They have enough food and territory and space to maintain a living. And so, but at some point you can't fit any more houses on the block, but one might sell and it might be vacant for a while and someone else buys it and moves in. And so that's kind of how the wolf packs establish on the landscape. And so when you look at Northeast Washington, we've kind of hit that capacity of the number of pack territories. There's a few little holes and places you might fit some in. You'll probably see Five Sisters come back on, or maybe Skookum, and some of those are going to go away. But that population, those numbers aren't going to change a whole lot over the next couple of years, I wouldn't anticipate. But it's in the North Cascades area and the South Cascades area where we're going to see those numbers change, and I'd expect more packs. There you have room for more houses and more fences, and they mark it with scats and urine and other things to mark their territory rather than put up fences, but it works similar. But there's more space and range to expand, so that's where I would expect those numbers to increase. To actually look at the numbers of the packs, our average numbers is about 4.3 wolves per pack, so a lot of small packs this year, particularly in the Eastern Washington recovery area. We did have one pack, Carpenter Ridge, that was 11 individuals. Grouse Flats was pretty large. It was at 8 individuals this year. A couple of the packs on the Caldwell Confederated Tribe were 6 or 7. The other thing that we calculate, it's difficult to calculate individual roaming wolves, but we look at the data where wolves have recolonized other states in the western U.S., and on average there's about 12.5% of individual wolves, dispersal wolves on the landscape, and so we buffer that number by that 12.5%, and that's added to that total number. We had 11 known mortalities in the eastern Washington recovery area, and there was 11 confirmed livestock depredations in that in the eastern Washington, confirmed mortalities in that area. There were 19 injured livestock that were confirmed in that recovery region. The North Cascades recovery region here is exciting in the sense that we have five packs in there now, and we had three successful breeding pairs, as I mentioned earlier, total number of 22 wolves, and then we had one known mortality in that area this past year. We did have one livestock mortality, and we had two confirmed injuries and one probable injury in that that region. So the overall numbers, we had 15 successful breeding pairs statewide for a total of 126 wolves. This is a minimum count. So we physically fly over with a helicopter or fixed-wing aircraft. We count number of tracks in each of the packs of individual animals, and we do the remote camera surveys. And so it's a physical count. It's how we do our trend over time, which is what other states have done as well. When they're in recovery phases, this is the method that they use so they could look at that status over time. We realize it is a minimum count, but that's it helps us assess where recovery is. So we did have two known dispersals. Both of those were from the Tushy Pack this past year. One went down to Idaho. Actually, let me get into – we'll get there. So if we look at it just consistency over time in those minimum counts, this is the minimum number of wolves. We're still increasing, albeit it wasn't a large increase this year as the total numbers. You know, part of that is because of that capacity in Northeast Washington, and we're still waiting for the North Cascades to kind of take off and the South Cascades for probably greater number increases. But successful breeding pairs, you know, having three in the North Cascades recovery area is exciting. We had a slight decrease in the northeastern part of the state, but we still had 12 breeding pairs, successful breeding pairs up in that area. The trend in the number of wolf packs, that again is, that's kind of our money in the bank for future recovery. And with those two individuals traveling out there, they'll get a chance to breed this spring, and then hopefully we'll have more wolves from those and successful breeding pairs from those five new packs. The known wolf mortalities, again, we monitor any of the known wolf mortalities that we have. It wasn't a lot different than any of the previous years. We had those 12 mortalities, but as the numbers increase, you can see it's not a significant increase over the last couple of years. It wasn't any increase. This is that dispersal that we were talking about from the Tushy Pack. So we had one yearling wolf that traveled down through Oregon and ended up down towards McCall, Idaho, and has stayed down there. It was dispersal age. I would expect that to happen on some of those in that age class. Then the female that was in the Tushy Pack ended up dispersing south, and when we did the count this winter, she was traveling with another individual. But then when we also did the count where she had left from, and there were four new wolves in that area, and so that was the Tushy Pack still. But the Butte Creek Pack is a new pack that was created right down on the border that shares between Oregon and Washington. And I'd also like to talk about that a little bit. One pack that we don't have on that map was the Walla Walla Pack. And so when we do these counts, the packs that are on the border, I talk with Oregon biologists, and when we look at a larger national count, I talk to her whether she includes that if they're breeding in Oregon or whether they're breeding in Washington. So they're breeding in Oregon, so that goes with her count. But there are some wolves south of Walla Walla there that do dip across the border from time to time that aren't on the main pack map. And so, you know, any of those border packs, we talk with the other jurisdictions and make sure we get an accurate count If they're breeding in Washington, we'll try and have them on our map here, and so we do that work as well. And so with our Washington wolf population summary, those are the numbers over time, just to get a better look. So this year we only had, in actual numbers, a 3% increase in growth rate, but our overall number is still about 28% over the time wolves have been recolonizing. 15 successful breeding pairs, 27 known packs, and 126 individual wolves. Five of the 27 packs were involved in livestock depredations this past year, so that's 19% of the population. So 81% of them are doing good things. There's just a couple of those packs that were causing trouble, and we try and work with folks in all the areas to help get non-lethal tools and things to minimize those conflicts. And so, but I'm going to let Dan jump into that.
Going back to, I think it was slide 12 that showed the maps of the, yeah, okay. That one. Yep. So you made the point about in Northeast Washington, there really isn't a whole lot more room for packs in there, and it's been fairly stable over these 4 years that you're showing. I think, and then you also sort of very quickly said, so you expect them to be moving into the other areas as the population grows. I think to add to that, I mean, that's sort of what we're seeing. Just to bring that out, do you want to, yeah.
No, absolutely. That's a great point. And so, and yes, there's a lot of room for expansion in the North Cascades and South Cascades, and I would expect to see more packs establishing in those areas
and
over time. And we have, yeah. And absolutely we have. And, you know, we've got the two new packs this year, and the successful breeding pairs, the packs that are there are mm-hmm. are breeding, and those pups are going to go somewhere as well. And so definitely that's a great point.
And then another point that I, or sort of question and point that I'd like to have you comment on is you emphasize that what we use to monitor our population is a count. Eyeball count. We see those wolves, and so it's a minimum. There are other ways. It's in biologic systems, kind of hard to count, and there are other ways of doing population estimates. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's definitely some multiple ways that you can do those estimates. There's multiple times a year that those estimates can come in. Our estimate or our count that we use, we do that at the time of the year when that population is typically the most stable. Some of the other work that's out there, I know Dr. Wasser at WSU or at UW put out a population estimate, and that is an estimate based on scat dog research that they did. But there's also other research we're looking into, and we're always looking for better ways to get these numbers and find out how to estimate those populations. We're working with Dr. Beth Gardner, and Sarah Bassing is a graduate student. Trent Rosine is a graduate student looking at auditory devices to look at howling surveys or howling out there on the landscape to get individual counts, remote cameras to get those counts. You know, there's a number of ways that are coming on. There's value to those counts, and there's good things and bad things about each of the methods that we use. The method we do is a consistency and a trend over time that we've been using and other states have used, and so it helps us understand where recovery is at this stage. But there's definitely other ways and other methods out there to do that, and we're looking at each of those and working with those folks.
Okay, great. Donnie.
Yes, add to that. So I've been fielding media calls today and yesterday as this information has gone public, and one of the questions that I've been getting is the discrepancy between the department's minimum counts and Dr. Wassner's estimate. And just wanted to add on to what Ben described, as he was describing the counts that we do that are minimums, and I just want to emphasize there are more wolves out there these, we know this is the minimum, is we do it when it's the population is the most stable, but also it's the time of year when the population is at its lowest. What I mean by that is you think about the biological year for wolves, their population is highest right after they produce pups. And then, of course, pup survival is not 100%. It's somewhere in the 50, 60% or so. And as those pups get older, the population within the year is declining because of pups, pup mortality and those kinds of things. And so the two methods are apples and oranges from one perspective, that the department's doing a minimum count during a period of time in the middle of winter when the population within the biological year is the lowest. Dr. Wassner does his work in the summer when you'd expect the population to be higher because of it's earlier in the year, closer to when pups are produced. So I just wanted to share that as well.
Yeah, and if I could just add on an observation, I think that this is a really important discussion because, you know, living in an area where wolves, there are wolves, and hearing my neighbors, particularly to the north, talk about, you know, we put out this count every year. Everybody knows there are more wolves. Being really clear, you know, we do a count for a specific reason. We're recovering wolves. We want as accurate a count. We recognize it's minimum. But acknowledging that, you know, this is a methodology. This is what we're looking for. We really know there are more wolves out there, and there are other ways of finding more wolves. So just think it's a very important conversation.
And then lastly, and I'll leave this, that our scientists are working with a good doctor, and so that they're more apples to apples. And so they are working together to try to look at those differences and be able to describe them better to the public.
Okay. Trying to get back to where we were. There we go.
Good afternoon. It's always a pleasure to be here in front of you and speak into a microphone. So I try to start out these slides with a little bit of humor, but Donnie wouldn't let me add the second part of this this particular slide. I had him going. I told him I'd put it back in. But so one goal of the Wolf Conservation Management Plan is to manage wolf conflicts in a way that minimizes wolf losses while not affecting, or minimizes livestock losses while not affecting the recovery and long-term perpetuation of a sustainable wolf population. In 2018, WDFW continued to deploy a variety of preventative measures to minimize the potential for livestock depredations caused by wolves. These methods include the use of fladry and electrified fladry, reg boxes, fox lights, livestock guarding dogs, hazing wolves from livestock and human residents, range riders, sharing data with producers and other governments to provide collar location, and the removal of injured or dead livestock from grazing areas that we call sanitation, and of course other techniques that could be used would include the removal of depredating wolves. I want to talk a little bit about our wildlife conflict specialists who do a really hard job and a very good job out in the field. Across the state, the Wildlife Conflict Management and Prevention Program deploys 16 wildlife conflict specialists and 3 supervisors out in the regions who have at least a portion of their time devoted to wildlife conflict issues. And then the headquarters staff includes myself, one biologist, 4 that serves as a statewide specialist, and a program specialist who manages the various contracts, compensation programs, and budgets. As you can imagine, wolf recovery in Washington is not the only conflict issue that we're responsible for. Our wildlife conflict specialists work with citizens statewide to resolve issues across the broad spectrum of wildlife species when their habitat overlaps with human activity. In the wolf world, the tools we have to use includes the direct coordination with producers, joining with them in damage preventative cooperative agreements, and our contracted range rider program. All of these use non-lethal deterrence methods to avoid wolf-livestock interaction. So our contracted range rider program. In 2018, WDFW contracted with 8 private organizations with a total of 15 range riders to provide services. Range riders were used to minimize wolf-livestock conflicts and to monitor livestock on open-range grazing allotments. Contractors are assigned to an area on an as-needed basis and are often responsible for multiple grazing allotments during a single assignment, thereby offering assistance to multiple operators. Similar to our damage prevention cooperative agreements, the non-lethal deterrence provided through the contracted range rider program includes human presence, sanitation efforts, livestock monitoring, and deployment of flattery and other scare devices. During the fiscal year, $241,000 was spent to provide this service to our constituents. And understand that when we're talking budget, we're talking fiscal year, so it doesn't actually capture the last half of the grazing season, which we had quite a banner year. Required a lot of resources, and from July 1 to present, we've spent $214,000. So that would be added then to that would be out of the fiscal year 19 budget. Thanks, Ben. Our cost share contracts and how we promote our deterrence measures. I want to talk a little bit about that. We had 31 damage prevention cooperative agreements for livestock with the livestock producers across Washington worth in excess of $250,000. Operators with an active agreement received a specified cost share percentage, usually 50%, for the different conflict prevention measures up to a maximum of $10,000 in any contract. The most common non-lethal prevention measures implemented during 2018 were for producer-employed range riders, improved sanitation, and flattery and fencing. Let's see. Is that another? No, that's the same slide. WDFW provides compensation payment for both the direct loss and injury of livestock caused by predating wolves and indirect losses such as above average loss, you know, those livestock that don't return at the end of the grazing season, reduced weight gain, and reduced pregnancy rates. Last year, WDFW paid a total of $7,536 in direct compensation to livestock producers who experienced losses or injuries by wolves. We also have a livestock review board for our indirect compensation. Its primary objective is to review claims filed for indirect losses that may have been caused by wolves and provide recommendations to WDFW to pay or deny claims. This board is comprised of 5 citizen members, with 2 representing the livestock industry, 2 representing conservation interests, and 1 at-large member. During 2018, 1 claim was filed, resulting in a payment of $5,950. As a side note, we are beginning a process to engage our stakeholders to collaboratively evaluate this our current livestock compensation programs in an effort to identify where we can improve the process and make the appropriate changes. So as a last resort, when we look at removing wolves that are depredating on livestock, we have our wolf protocol, and much has been said about that. It takes into consideration the non-lethal measures that were used, takes in consideration the number and time frame within which wolf depredations have occurred, the 4 and 10 month window, the 3 and 30 day, and these are all factors that are included in the decision making process. So the protocol is a guideline to help Director Suzawin ultimately make final determination of a lethal removal. In 2018, 4 wolves from 3 packs were removed. A 5 of the 27 or 19% of known packs, and one independent wolf that existed in Washington at some point during 2018 when were involved in at least one confirmed livestock mortality. The depredation statistics shown here are based on the confirmed wolf-caused livestock mortalities in Washington from 2007 through 2018. Reported livestock mortalities reported here are livestock mortalities, and they don't reflect loss or missing livestock. In 2018, confirmed livestock mortalities caused by wolves in Washington included 11 cattle and one sheep. Depredation investigations also confirmed 19 cattle and two sheep as being injured by wolves. Most livestock injuries and mortalities occurred during the summer grazing season, as you can see on this graph. And I guess with that, unless there's any questions, we'll go back to Ben, and he can talk about some of the current research that is going on.
Hey, thanks, Dan. So one of the things that we always try and compile as part of the annual report is what kind of research is going on. And it's really important. One of our objectives is to look at, to make sure we have healthy ungulate populations. And so as wolves have recolonized the state, there was a legislative appropriation to begin a predator-prey project. And so that's focused in Northeast Washington. There's a number of students that are working on various parts of that project through University of Washington. And so we're looking at the ungulate predator dynamics. We're looking at interactions between wolves and cougars. And we're looking at interactions of the large and small carnivores, the coyotes and bobcats as well, in that mix, and looking at different spatial and temporal dynamics between predator-prey. And we've got collars on whitetails and mule deer and elk. There was a study finishing up on moose and out of the University of Montana, and they're wrapping that up in the next year or so. And then all those folks are focused on looking at the effects of wolves and the effects of having wolves on the landscape with all the other species there. And so it's a large project. It's ongoing. We've got two research scientists with the department working on that, Dr. Brian Kurtzen and Dr. Malia DeVivo. And so that project is ongoing. We did have one project complete this year. Azura, she was working at WSU looking at stress hormones in cattle and on free-ranging livestock in the presence of wolves and without wolves. And so that dissertation is going to be available shortly. She's just wrapping up edits on that. She just recently finished. And so that's something to look forward to here shortly. So, and then with that, I'm going to pass this on to Donnie, and he's going to...
Thank you, Ben. Commission Chair, members of the Commission, Director, my name is Donnie Martorell. I'm the Wolf Policy Lead for Washington Department Fish and Wildlife. I'm just going to finish up our last few slides here. So a little bit on the expenditures for wolf conservation management. This is a fiscal year look. You can see down at the total, about $1.2 million, a little over that. One of the questions that we commonly get of that, what portion is to try to prevent conflict with wolves and livestock or to address the conflict? So we've broken those out here specifically, where you can see in the fiscal year, about $511,000 for those top three rows. Pretty similar to what I've reported in the past, where for a biennium, we're spending about $1 million or so on the conflict side of things. One of the other questions I often get is, what about the lethal removal? Is that more expensive? From a biennium perspective, if you think about the $1 million that we spend on wolf livestock kinds of conflict things, about 10% of that is for lethal removal. The other point, so in the last one here, the $705,000, that's the various other things, the research efforts, the collaring, the collars, the staff, and the list goes on. And happy to provide any more detail on the budget if you'd like it. My last note on this slide is that when you look at the print there at the bottom in white, two funding sources make up about 90% of that $1.2 million. Personalized license plate, about 60%. And then just a little over 30% general fund state. Next slide. Next, kind of just check in on the progress and workings of the Wolf Advisory Group. During 2018, the Wolf Advisory Group met four times. They provide, as you know, recommendations or guidance to the department on the implementation of the Wolf Conservation Management Plan. In the past years, they spent quite a bit of time on, they worked on a number of things, but one of their bigger items has been on a recommendation for Wolf Livestock Interactions Protocol. That's something that they're working on a little bit more this year, some tweaks to that. But they've also kind of added a new large kind of topic to their workload. They're starting to think about our next Wolf Conservation Management Plan and what that might look like. We'll be starting a EIS and SEPA process. It'll probably take about 3 years. And we'll be really looking to the Wolf Advisory Group for recommendations on that plan development. Next slide. A little bit on outreach. Feels like on outreach we could always be doing more. That's certainly something we'd like to take a bigger bite out of the apple, looking ahead as more outreach about wolf conservation management. As you've seen, our new website is launched. It's more user-friendly and you've heard, I'm sure, from staff, for smartphones and things like that. And I mention that because we have a dedicated page for public updates, and feel good that we provide at a minimum a monthly update, but so many more than that through the course of the year. We have a pretty regular information going on our webpage about wolves, keep the public informed about what's going on. And then, of course, there are a myriad of calls and meetings and all those sorts of things, and then more formal presentations that you can see there. And we have started in this last few months doing a Wolf 101 at various communities in Eastern Washington. Next slide. Just wanted to touch real quickly on wolf translocation. You all recall that in the 2018 budget proviso that we were directed to consider a wolf translocation as a means to address wolf recovery in the state. So we're initiating that process, been working on it. We've been connecting with our federal partners and the tribes, kind of the pre-scoping, and then here next month we'll be starting the official scoping process for considering SEPA translocation. And I wanted to call out one of our folks that's the lead on this. It's Julia Smith. She's here behind me. If Julia, the wave there. She's the lead on wolf translocation. She came on about 5 months ago. We stole her from the Southwest where she worked on a Mexican wolf project, and we're very lucky to have her, and she's going to do a great job on that. Next slide. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and bring us home with a discussion on that started last October as our periodic status review of wolves. But before I do that, I'm going to read out of your commission rule just real quickly what a periodic species status review is, and just a couple sections of it. Section 10.1, the agency shall conduct a review of each endangered, threatened, or sensitive wildlife species at least every 5 years after the date of its listing. We're overdue on that. We're doing our first one now. The review shall include an update of the species status report to determine whether the status of the species warrants its current listing status or deserves reclassification. The agency shall notify any parties that have expressed their interest to the department of the periodic status review. The notice shall occur at least 1 year prior to the end of the 5-year period required in this section. We provided our notice in October of 2018, and we'll be coming to you, I think, in the this coming winter, but in the December to February time period likely. I'm sorry, December to February time period with the completion of that periodic status review. This slide, leave it here. So now I'm going to flip back, and or Ben's going to do it for me. We're going to flip back and forth between two slides to describe for you kind of where are we at with wolves now in Washington and status and what's in our plan and those kinds of things. And so as Ben described, 27 packs, 15 total successful breeding pair. We have three recovery areas. In the eastern recovery region, from a plan perspective, our metric is successful breeding pair. In the eastern area, we have 12 successful breeding pair. North Cascades, we have 3. South Cascades, Coast, we have 0. So, and those are the three recovery areas. So now let's just take this line by line, describe what this is. So these first three columns are the three recovery areas that we just talked about. And then here's the different listing classifications. And so in our plan, it calls to have two successful breeding pair in each of the three recovery regions over three consecutive years to consider downlisting to threatened. Similarly, you can see that then to sensitive, it's going to be four successful breeding pair in each of those regions for three consecutive years to consider downlisting to sensitive. And then we'll get to the delisting one here. It's going to get a little more complicated. Four successful breeding pair in each of those recovery regions for three consecutive years to delist. Now, in that case, not only are there the four successful breeding pair required in each area, but a minimum of three floaters that can be anywhere in the state. So I'm going to stop there and go back and describe kind of where we're at. Bad term. So you can see we have 12 in the eastern recovery area. Ben just got done talking about close to saturation there. The pieces of the puzzle are filling in. So we've well exceeded the two to downlist to threatened or the four to downlist to sensitive or to delist. And so when in doing that, if we're in the delist category, because we are, you know, four or three times the number of successful breeding pair, we've met the three floaters. In fact, we've over than met the three floaters. So in this case, to downlist to threatened, we haven't reached our two successful breeding pair in the coastal region. The South Cascades are coastal. To downlist to sensitive, we haven't reached the four. We're very close in the North Cascades that you just heard today. We're at three successful breeding pair, first time. And so we're very, very close there. We're expecting more growth. For delisting, again, we're pretty close in North Cascades, but we don't have any in the South Cascades coastal area. And then there is this one last bit of complication that I'll do my best to describe. So then there is another layer to consider delisting, and that is 18 successful breeding pair for 1 year. It's got to meet the four, four, and four, and this time there has to be six floaters anywhere. But again, we've already met the floaters because we've surpassed in the eastern recovery area by quite a bit. And so the floaters is met. We're one shy in the North Cascades or four shy in the South Cascades coastal to delist with 18 successful breeding pair, but no consecutive year requirement. Clear as mud? So that is, when you think about the periodic status review, that is what is articulated in our wolf plan. You don't have to scroll back, sorry. Yeah, right there, here you go. So the next section here, and I'm going to quickly, I'm sorry to read this stuff, but quickly read this. And so if you think about what you're going to be in front of you in this winter, it's a review of our wolf population. We're also doing it's a comparison to our plan. Where are we that we just saw just now? Where are we compared to what the downlisting or delisting criteria of our plan? And then there's also going to be what we're working on now is a status review of our existing wolf population in Washington. When you think about the model that we did in the wolf plan and that Ben published a little later a few years ago, we were using parameters from our neighboring states, from Idaho and Montana and other places. Now we have those parameters for our own wolf population in Washington. So we're going to be, right now we are pulling that information together. We'll be incorporating that into the model that was developed to really get a look at where is Washington's wolf population? How robust is it? And so that's the other thing we'll be bringing to you. So some of the things that we'll be talking about more as we approach that. So if you think about, and I don't want to emphasize the word delisting here. You're per rule, you're looking at any changes in listing status. I'm just pulling out some of the things that are in that rule. So for delisting criteria, there are two items. I'm starting here at 4.1. The commission shall delist a wildlife species from endangered, threatened, or sensitive solely based on the biological status of the species being considered and based on the preponderance of scientific data available. And so if we reach, just for conversation's sake, 18 successful breeding pair for 1 year, and we meet the distribution requirements, That doesn't mean wolves are just delisted. We still have to go through a process to look at the best available information, the biological status of wolves, before wolves would be a change in their listing status. 4.2, a species may be delisted from endangered, threatened, or sensitive only when the populations are no longer in danger of failing, declining, and no longer vulnerable to the things in 3.3, which is above here just for your reference. And then, or meet the recovery plan goals, and when it no longer meets the definition of endangered, threatened, or sensitive, which I have on the last slide. And so the point here is, as I described, we're going to be bringing two things to you. One, a comparison to our plan, but we're also going to evaluate our Washington wolf population to see if it's no longer in danger of failing, declining, or no longer vulnerable to failing, declining, or limited numbers, disease, predation, exploitation, habitat loss, or change. Also clear as mud.
Donnie, what you're saying is that as we decide whether this population is recovered sometime into the future, you're going to, well, I guess we, but the scientists will be looking at two different, completely different criteria. One listed in 4.1 and one listed in 4.2. Are those we need to meet them both, or is it an and or? If they aren't considered for a different listing under 4.2, but are under 4.1, are you going to be bringing that to us? How does it work practically?
We're going to be. It's a good question. There's a lot there.
Yeah, it's more than necessary, actually.
If I understand it correctly. We are going to be bringing to you the wolf population status compared to what's on our plan, the recovery objectives. And when you think about the plan tries to assess that this information about no longer danger of failing, declining, or vulnerable to those things listed up here, the plan is a projection of that in 2011, and a good projection, right? We have a strong, strong plan. But it's that we're at that time where the plan is a plan, and wild populations, as we know, are, you know, lots of factors out there, and is recovery going as we expected? And so we're going to be looking at also our wolf population as it currently is to see how it compares to these statements that are in this rule. And so we'll be bringing everything that's in that rule associated with the periodic status review and items relative to this section and the classification of the different, next slide please, and relevant to the benchmarks for endangered, threatened, and sensitive. So what you'll be considering, as you've done, and I emphasize this, for this is nothing new for wolves, right? This is the rule that you use for any change in listing status for any species. We'll be following that rule in terms of the periodic status review, but also fleshing out these other items. So you'll have all that information available for any decision you may make. And I don't want to make it sound as though, we're not. There is no pre-decision here, pre-judgment here. We are going to comply with the rule, do the assessment, look at our current wolf population, also compare it to where we are in the plan, and have all that information out on the table.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions on the delisting. First, on the federal level, why is it that they are delisted on the east side and endangered on the west side from a federal perspective?
You bet. Go back to that. Just the map right there. The question is why is this sliver federally delisted and yet the remaining of the part of the state is federally listed? And the if we were to show the other states over here, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, when the federal government, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, created a distinct population segment for that population, they included this part of Washington and a sliver of Oregon as the distinct population for the Northern Rocky Mountains wolf population. So when they delisted Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, they also federally delisted this section and the corner of Oregon. And so the rule that they're proposing now delists gray wolves and the remainder part of the lower 48 where it's listed specific to gray wolves. And so it picks up the remaining part of Washington and other areas where they're federally listed right now.
So it's just a technicality of where they drew a line?
The technicality was they wanted to include that buffer around those three states for dispersal and the average dispersal distance of wolves. And so that's why it has the buffer around those portion of that DPS.
Okay. And then on the state delisting, the question is on slide 36, 4.1. You said something about even if we met all the criteria, we'd have to go through another process under 4.1, delisting criteria 4.1. We'd have to go through another process because of something about scientific data. Now, I presume we're going to use scientific data to determine whether or not we meet the criteria. So could you say again what that nuance was?
Yes. If I understand the question correctly, when we meet the one of the recovery objectives in the plan, whether it's 15 successful breeding pair for three consecutive years or 18 for one, just the fact that we've met that doesn't trigger delisting. Once we've met that, it would trigger a status review of the actual current population to make sure that that population is actually not and no longer risk of declining or failure. And so after, when a population reaches its recovery objectives in a plan, there is one last status review at the end of that process.
One just last one. Then under 4.2, it says only when populations, plural, doesn't say only when the statewide population is or the aggregate population is. It says only when populations. Is that a pack, a population?
That's a good point. It's populations. In other places, it refers to it as species, and so that's one of the things we'll go back and get more clarity on. Are we talking about a pack? Are we talking about a recovery area? Are we talking about the entire population in Washington? We're not quite that far yet.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I feel the need to perhaps clarify just a little. I don't want to imply that we'll go through this whole PSR process and then if and when we meet recovery plan objectives, there would be a subsequent periodic status review. In general, if you were to work through a recovery plan and hit that target, that meeting the goals itself isn't the distinction that allows a change in status. You have to show that you've met these criteria in the WAC to do a downlisting or a delisting. And so in this case, the periodic status review is ongoing. And so the message and the information that we'll provide to the commission will be both. It'll be the status review of the population and also as it compares to the recovery plan. I just want to make sure we didn't have an impression that there would be a second periodic status review unless one is needed. So if we got through this process and we still have a status of either sensitive, threatened, or endangered, there will be more time and then there would still be a subsequent periodic status review. But that doesn't necessarily have to happen.
Gotcha. Yep.
That's all we have. Last slide is that's the end.
Very good. Probably asked all the questions already. Anybody else? We're running a little behind schedule, so let's go around and see who has any questions, and we'll move on. Anybody on the left?
Well, just an observation in response to Commissioner McIsaac. I don't think the feds drew an arbitrary line when they developed the distinct population status. It is called the Northern Rockies population, and northeastern Washington and southeastern Washington are Northern Rockies. I mean, it's a contiguous landscape.
Oregon.
Yeah, and northeastern
they
Oregon.
Like
yeah, so that's part of what you look at with a distinct population segment.
Yeah, so my question is whether it's with some sort of a claim that there are distinct populations between our line, one side or the other. So North Cascade, is that distinct than the Eastern?
It is not. Federally, it is not a distinct population.
Yes.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you next time. Soon.